Before we get into today's episode, I want to share a timely free resource with you. When you look at the headlines, war, instability, constant talk about the end times, it's easy to feel anxious or unsure what to think. But the Bible offers a better way. Our short guide, Watchful, Not Worried, End Times, the Second Coming, and How to Read the News with Biblical Hope, will help you understand what Scripture really says about the end times, so you can live with clarity, hope, and confidence instead of fear. You'll discover how to read the news through the lens of Scripture, avoid speculation, and stay grounded in God's bigger story. Download your free copy today at premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, at kitchen tables or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad, John Wyatt. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Tim.
And today we wanted to move the conversation on from that really interesting chat we had a few weeks ago with Justin Brierley talking about this idea of a quiet revival, what he calls the surprising rebirth, but take it, kind of roll it one step back and look at this idea of enchantment. Is general society, atheistic secular society, starting to kind of fall back in love with the idea of a world that is a bit more mysterious, a bit more magical, a bit more spiritual, even if they're not actually yet ready to call themselves believers? And I don't know if you spotted that, but there's been some really interesting survey data in the last 12 months or so. There was a really interesting survey which was published in the Times here in the UK, which found that members of Gen Z, so that's people in their kind of teens and 20s, they are much less likely to identify as atheists than either their middle-aged parents, so that's Generation X, or their baby boomer grandparents. That's your guys, a study has found. So when you look at just Gen Z, that's those aged under 25, only 13% identified as atheists. Compared to their parents in Gen X, which are the most irreligious group, 25%, one in four, identified as atheists. And even baby boomers, it was only 20%. So that's still significantly higher than 13%. And the same is true in reverse. When you look at identifying as very or fairly spiritual, some 62% of 18 to 24-year-olds said they were very or fairly spiritual, which is almost double baby boomers. So those over 65, only 35% of baby boomers said they were very or fairly spiritual. So something really interesting here that I think the assumption has been from a lot of people that religiosity, spirituality, is going to progressively decline each generation that we get from the kind of collapse in belief in the middle of the 20th century. But actually, that seems to be not the case.
Yeah, it is fascinating because this has always been the narrative, you know, from modernity, which starts really in the 18th century Enlightenment, that basically religion is superstition. It's just due to darkness. Now we bring the light of science and rationality. And as light spreads across the population, what will be apparent is all these silly superstitions will fade away. Religion will fade away. And that narrative that religiosity, religious superstition, you know, is just spreading away. There was the famous poem, wasn't there, about Dover Beach, that was the,
yes,
like the receding
Matthew Arnold, the sea of faith, yeah
the receding tide of religious belief, you know, there was just an echo. And here we are in a world where science and technology is absolutely everywhere and dominant, where scientific ideas are commonplace, you know, where every child is taught science and scientific attitudes at school. And yet, here we are with Gen Zers who are showing such high rates. I'm seeing a survey which says approximately 80% of Gen Zers, both male and female, describe themselves as spiritual or believing in a higher power.
Mm. I guess we should point out that this is not the same as being religious, let alone actually practicing a faith. In fact, you know, when you look at the best survey data, like the British Social Attitudes Survey, the numbers of people who say that they're not Christians, for instance, continues to tick up each year they do that survey. So these, what we're talking about really, are often people who are sometimes called spiritual but not religious, SBNR in the kind of jargon of surveys. And the fact that there is jargon tells you, right, this is a group that's been identified for a while. But I think Gen Z seem to have kind of pushed that forward in a way beyond some maybe my own millennial generation. So in this survey I read in the Times, it's when you asked how do they feed their sense of the spiritual, Gen Z were more likely to cite things such as enjoying nature or mindfulness than the option they were given of participating in religious practices. So I think a lot of people, they're very happy with the language of spirituality, very happy to say that they don't believe in a kind of sterile, arid, purely scientific, materialist, naturalist universe, but they're not necessarily therefore saying, and that's why I believe in, you know, orthodox creedal Christianity or equally orthodox creedal Islam, but they're believing in a more of a kind of amorphous grab bag of spiritual practices and beliefs.
And it's a very interesting word, isn't it? Spiritual. And I think it's one of the first things to say, isn't it, that it's a very vague, and when people talk about, this is a problem with the word spirituality, isn't it? You know, I'm a very spiritual person. Oh, yes, I believe in spirituality. I mean, what does that mean?
Basically, whatever you want it to mean.
Yeah. I mean, all it means is something that isn't the dead, materialistic machinery. You know, that
life is more than atoms and molecules.
Exactly. There is something spiritual, but what that is and what relation it has to sort of organized creedal faiths like Christianity is another matter entirely.
Yes. And I think you see some of this vagueness, this ambiguity in the kind of absolute smorgasbord of kind of spirituality that is popular. I mean, you've got everything from kind of a lot of new age practices have come back around again, like tarot cards and crystals and Reiki, and there's things like mindfulness. But then you have other kind of more contemporary stuff like manifesting. But even you could say beliefs in things like, you know, UFOs and aliens or conspiracy theories are sometimes act for some people, I think, as a form of spirituality, even if not overtly understood as such. They're kind of a way of re-injecting a mystical, magical, imaginative, enchanting, you could use to coin a term, kind of lens to the universe.
That's right. And I think it is interesting that this term enchantment and disenchantment it has become a very popular vogue kind of concept. And it's interesting just to go back a little bit to see where this comes from. And it's really the German sociologist Max Weber, who was the first one to say, he made a comparison between modernity and the pre-modern view. And the idea was that the pre-modern view was a world where there was mystery and spiritual presence, sometimes called a porous universe. And that what happened with the Enlightenment and the rise of science and so on was that that world was the magical element, the mysterious element was removed, and the world becomes disenchanted. And Charles Taylor, a very influential Canadian philosopher, also took that on and describes it in great detail in his books, that this shift. And he came up with this phrase of the buffered self, that the self is now living in its own little world, making up its meaning, because out there is, the world is just disenchanted. We've got rid of all the magic. And it's interesting that, I mean, many Christian thinkers, including the reformers, argued that actually that was one of the things that Christianity did before the Enlightenment. Christianity was one of the forces which strove against animism. You know, this idea that everywhere there were gods living in the tree, there were gods in your home, there were gods everywhere. And what Christianity said, no, there's only one God. And that's just a tree. It's a tree which is an organism which is growing, and you don't need to see some hidden spiritual thinking within that tree. So the idea is that I'm now locked inside this little ego because outside world is disenchanted. But it's interesting to see that actually many Christian thinkers saw there was a great deal in favour of this disenchantment, because it fought against a kind of pagan belief that the gods were everywhere, of animism. You know, that the idea was that in the world of animism, everything had a god. So there were gods in my home, there were gods in my garden, there were gods in the woods, and I had to be constantly aware that I couldn't, you know, I might be offending a god somewhere. And what Christianity says is, no, there's only one god, and that tree is just a tree. It's just a living organism, you know, and that thing you've got in your home is just an idol, which has no meaning. Mm. So there was some of that disenchantment that Christianity brought, which was actually positive.
Yes, and that's a kind of key argument from the reformers there, a kind of critique of Catholicism and medieval Catholicism or late early modern Catholicism, was that it kind of played into these kind of non-Christian paganistic ideas about the world being full of demons and angels and saints, and they didn't like things like transubstantiation, which is a kind of, you know, a form of magic where the priest can magically turn the wine into blood during the sacraments. Obviously, that's a kind of pastiche of Catholic theology of communion, but there was a sense in which the corrupted church they were trying to reform had kind of colluded with this pagan folk belief and syncretized it into Christianity, and they were trying to purge it of that, take people back to the Bible, which is, I think, as you say, has some merit, but kind of ignores the fact that the world of the New Testament, let alone the Old, was in itself an incredibly enchanted place. I mean, the people who wrote and who feature in the page of the New Testament very much did not live in a kind of arid, sterile, post-Enlightenment kind of universe, as we discussed in our conversation about evil.
Yeah, and so these are complex shifts, aren't they? So you start with this degree of saying, look, the world is not, you know, we're not accepting superstition and the belief that there are gods everywhere. But then that moves into this completely dead universe of the modern scientific materialistic world. And what we're now seeing, you know, this was the new atheism, wasn't it? This was new atheism was promoting this idea,
yeah,
that that all religious belief, all belief in spirits, this is just superstition. You know, we invent our own meaning, but we, at root, we know that the world is just atoms and physics.
Yeah. And you saw that in the kind of derision of, you know, believing in your magical sky fairy because your Stone Age book told you so. But we moderns have gone beyond that needless pagan superstition, and we can embrace the kind of arid sterility of the universe. It's just atoms and stars and dust, and we just collect together for a brief time, and then this earth will be consumed by the sun. Your life has no meaning. And they kind of celebrate that. And yet it actually is quite, I think, relatively few people chime with that kind of view of the universe.
Well, it's popular amongst the elite. You know, the older elite, the baby boomers, the academic institutions, even teachers. You know, I was very struck when some time ago I was doing some talks and discussions in a secular school, and discovered that really the majority of the teaching staff were completely hooked by Yuval Noah Harari's books about sapiens and about Homo Deus, you know, the very, very materialistic understanding about humanity. This was the orthodoxy amongst the teaching staff. It's interesting that it wasn't among the students.
No, and I think that's intriguing. And I think that's why a lot of Christians get quite excited about that idea of that we've gone through a cycle from enchantment to disenchantment. And this is not a new idea. I mean, Weber wrote this in the early 1900s. And it's been picked up again across the 20th century. Charles Taylor's famous book was over almost 20 years ago. And now they say we're identifying a re-enchantment in those things like, you know, tarot cards and witchcraft and TikTok and New Age stuff, mindfulness, manifesting crystals. And this is exciting because the reformers maybe went too far and they drained the world. And the Enlightenment said it drained the world of enchantment. And actually, for Christianity to take root in people's souls, people need to be re-enchanted. So you see a lot of Christians writing with kind of excitement about this process of re-enchantment, even though a lot of these things that kind of spiritual but not religious Gen Zers are pursuing seem kind of antithetical to Orthodox Christianity.
Yeah, and I think that it's just important to know that, isn't it? Because I think particularly for my generation of the baby boomers, you know, we're pretty ignorant about what is actually going on with this generation. And the sort of things that are happening on the internet. One of the things I'm interested about, but really can't get my head around, is this concept of manifesting, you know, which people talk about, and is this weird idea that I was just looking it up. What is manifesting? And it's the idea is that if you really passionately believe in something of what you want to happen, You then attract it, you know, whatever it is, a successful business, better health, a relationship, whatever it is, as if you really believe it, then you can align with the loving energy of the universe and there are no limits to what you can attract.
Yeah, it's a kind of a slightly mystical version of kind of what was sometimes called the power of positive thinking. You know, there was a big moment about that. I think in the 80s there was a book or something like that.
Earlier than that,
yeah. It was earlier than that, yeah. And manifesting, yeah, has become very popular in the last kind of, I think it really exploded around the pandemic, maybe something to do with, you know, everyone being locked inside and dreaming and visualizing a better future for themselves. But yeah, it's very, very popular. And I think it's a bit like mindfulness. It's a kind of low stakes version of dabbling in something that's spiritual, but doesn't come freighted with some of the associations that you might get if you start doing tarot card readings or Reiki healing. It's a bit kind of, I'm not a kook. I just, you know, I think I believe in the power of positive thinking and I think it's interesting and you can try and visualize and act like what you want is already here and you can draw things towards you by the power of your will alone.
What's astonishing about manifesting is how consumerist it is. I mean, this is a sort of late modernity consumerism meets sort of weird spirituality, you know, so... What are people manifesting? They're not manifesting the desire that they're going to be, you know, amazingly peaceful and no. able to give away all their wealth. They're manifesting becoming a TikTok influencer with a million followers, yeah. and having a private
winning the lottery,
plane
yeah.
and so on.
Yes, and I think that draws out something quite interesting about our current version of re-enchantment, is that it is effortlessly absorbed into our kind of late capitalist society, and that's an interesting counterpoint, I think, to an earlier era of this, which I think we should dwell on for a second, which is kind of the 1960s counterculture, which you lived through and I very much did not, in many ways had similar elements of a kind of modern rationalist post-enlightenment Western societies kind of growing tired and looking for something exciting, for something spiritual. You know, you had Westerners traveling to ashrams in India and getting interested in Hinduism and Buddhism, people exploring new, I mean, that's where the New Age concept kind of is birthed, you know, people exploring the idea that there is, you know, more to than just what science can explain about the universe. Do you feel like there are resonances with that, what we're experiencing now in the 2020s?
Well, it's very interesting to compare and contrast because, as you say, I did actually live through the 60s. I was a, a sort of 13, 14-year-old when the Beatles first appeared. And then when I was at university, it was very big, you know, the Beatles, Monty Python. You know, what was happening in the 60s was it was a reaction really against everything that was regarded as the establishment, you know, and that in, that was sometimes described as the military-industrial complex. You know, it was a, it, there was
the
a
man.
Reaction against,
don't do what the man tells you.
Yeah, yeah, and the Vietnam War represented in the States all that was wrong and evil about the establishment, and it was there was a kind of revolt. Discovering youth, the power of youth, the power of protest. I mean, it's interesting that there was a huge amount of sexual promiscuity. I mean, the 60s was, it was free love, man, you know.
Communes
you
and hippies.
You know, there was a famous line from a song, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. You know, it's, it, it, it's, yeah. And so this kind of extraordinary, you know, mass love-ins and orgies and that said, that the sexual element was very strong in the 1960s, along with this protest. And but there was definitely a turn to the East, and the Beatles famously had their own guru, and they went through this phase when they were into Eastern mysticism. Everything that came out of the East was positive versus this Western complex, and a lot of emphasis on cults, you know, weird kind of Californian wellness cults and so on. So yeah, there are definitely points of resonance, but it was a very different phenomenon. It's interesting where now the idea of having mass orgies is, you know, for goodness sake, you're going to catch some infection. You know? It's much safer to stay on your smartphone.
Gen Z having less sex than any generation before them, and certainly less than their baby boomers' grandparents were in the 1960s. And I think what's interesting for me, looking back and kind of reading about that era, is, as you say, how much of it was a rejection of everything that the kind of the their parents, so the people who kind of fought in World War II, that generation. So it rejected their hairstyles, their clothes, their music, but also their religion. You know, their parents were dutiful, you know, Christians going to very mainstream churches, and the countercultural kind of 60s hippies, the young, they went the opposite direction. They went the other side of the world and explored Eastern religions and mystic religions. It wasn't, they were being re-enchanted, but it wasn't leading them any closer to Orthodox Christianity. If anything, it was taking them further away. Whereas I guess the hope in the modern version of this re-enchantment, potentially because we've come so far out of Christendom, that Christianity itself becomes mystical and exotic and unusual and enchanting. And actually there being, it could re-enchantment lead people back to faith today, because they're being re-enchanted not out of a kind of arid, sterile, post-Enlightenment Protestantism, but they are being re-enchanted out of an arid, sterile, post-Christendom atheism.
Yeah, I think there's a huge amount in that, and I think there is no doubt that there is a new spiritual awareness, a spiritual hunger. As you say, isn't it fascinating that Christianity has become exotic? And there is so little knowledge about the Bible and about Jesus, and that actually, for quite a few young people, it's genuinely interesting. It's strange and exotic. So I think there are real opportunities here, but I do think there's a kind of naivety about not just in Gen Z, but also I think it possibly in some of the Christian communities as well, who are so keen to see this as a positive turn that they don't recognize the risk of what some people have called a dark re-enchantment, that actually this is going back to some of the dark pagan pre-Christian interests.
If you've ever struggled to fully understand the New Testament or explain your faith with confidence, you're not alone. That's exactly why Premier Insight exists, and why your support matters right now. When you give today, we'll send you a special thank you gift, the New Testament You Never Knew Bible Study Guide by N.T. Wright. It will help you understand the context, meaning, and story of Scripture more clearly. And your support helps others do the same through programs like this. So please give your best gift today and request your copy. Just go to premierinsight.org/matters-of-life-and-death. Thank you for helping people engage God's word with wisdom and understanding.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, kitchen tables, or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And certainly it's not hard to understand why we might be we wouldn't celebrate as a church the fact that tarot cards and Ouija boards and occultic kind of elements are witchcraft are kind of surging on platforms like TikTok. Is it preferable to kind of a Dawkins-style new atheism? Is it any closer to true Orthodox Christian faith? And actually, unlike Dawkins-style atheism, it can, as we discussed in our previous episode about evil, we do actually believe in spiritual forces. The world is enchanted, whether people are believe it or not. The world is enchanted by evil, demonic, spiritual forces. And few people stumble into demonology through Dawkins-style atheism. It's a lot easier to do that if you're messing around with Ouija boards and tarot cards on TikTok.
Yeah, and even something as apparently sort of enlightenment as AI, actually, bizarrely, can become a conduit for really dark stuff. I mean, we know about these cases where, young people using AI have found themselves addicted, AI psychosis we've talked about. There have been these tragic cases of suicide caused by AI. So it seems as though it is possible for this highly sophisticated technology, paradoxically, to become a conduit for dark powers, dark forces.
Mm. And I guess there's a kind of tension, therefore, in the church's response. Some people would want to lean into re-enchantment as a kind of necessary first step towards revival. We're not going to get people interested in the God of the Bible until we first break their kind of obsession that the world is atoms and molecules. And maybe this kind of panoply of strange spirituality that people indulge in, this smorgasbord of new age stuff, is a kind of precursor, an in-between, a bridge between the world of Dawkins and the world of Christ. But then there were others who want to tick up the language of the reformers and say, well, actually, we need a new reformation to kind of purge popular culture of this pagan, idolatrous forms of spirituality before we can bring people into true faith with the living God.
Yeah, it's interesting that if you go back right to the early Christian church and the missionary movement that spread out from the early Christian church in the first centuries after Christ, in fact, missionary church leaders who were involved in this kind of outreach, they developed quite a sophisticated approach to the pagan religions that they were that Christianity was that when it was Christianity spread into lands, including the UK, Great Britain, that was dominated by pagan religions, and the advice that was often given by missionary strategists of the early church was not to directly oppose the pagan practices, but to find ways to Christianize them. And that's, of course, why we have things like Christmas and Easter, and that what actually happened was that pagan practices, which happened at that time of the year,
were baptized.
Of course, Easter also relates to the Jewish calendar, but nonetheless, there was this very interesting and quite sophisticated approach to paganism, not just to simply say that's all wrong, you get rid of all that stuff. Now, it was to say, how can we see the good in this, but then redeem it, convert it into something much healthier?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I remember I did a reporting trip many years ago to Ecuador to cover their Holy Week, so the week leading up to Easter, which is kind of a panoply of sights and sounds and interesting cultural experiences in this what was historically been a very Catholic country. But one of the tour guides kept pointing out when we were visiting various cathedrals and observing kind of processions and things, that if you look carefully, you can still see elements of pre-Catholic indigenous kind of Andean worship, which the Catholic missionaries in the 1500s encountered when they landed in Latin America. And even carved into the some of the frescoes and things in the cathedrals are elements that he says were to encourage the locals to come in. You know, they for example, were into worshipping various kinds of fruits. And so you see these fruits were kind of added into the frescoes surrounding a kind of icon of the Virgin or something like that. And it's a form of syncretism. It's a kind of way of treading a careful line, saying we don't want to just kind of scorched earth torch everything you have believed for generations and then say, now come and be Christians. We want to try and lead you gently by the hand, which is, we should say, it's not always how the church has done it. There are other colonial encounters where the Christians have very much sought to kind of chop down the idols and enforce Christianity at the point of a sword.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. And even, I understand, you know, the medieval European cathedrals, for instance, I mean, things like gargoyles, you know, why have you got little images of horrendous evil people with water spouting out of their mouths? You know, I think these are, again, references to a kind of pagan practices which have been incorporated into the building. So there's a sort of interesting sort of features going on here. But what the early church emphasized, therefore, was the importance of what they call catechizing, or what we would probably call discipleship or spiritual formation. You know, the most important thing is that once you have become a Christian, that we now teach you and really form you.
Unlearn some of the things
the things you've learned, and now we form you in a authentically and robust Christian understanding of the cosmos.
And I think you see that, you know, when you read commentaries on some of the Pauline epistles, some of his direct kind of messaging to the churches in Corinth or Ephesus or Galatia or wherever, some theologians and church kind of biblical studies experts interpret some of this as, you know, he is saying this in particular because we think that there are converts in the congregation who were maybe had wittingly or otherwise introduced kind of elements of their previous pagan worship of Diana into this Christian congregation. And he's trying to offer some advice and guidance about how to thread that needle and things like that. So I think that certainly it will be intriguing to see if that becomes, if as some people hope, this kind of re-enchantment in the 2020s does lead to kind of meaningful numbers of people then finding their way into the church. As you say, there will be a big job of catechesis of formation and discipleship, so that we can, you know, someone who found their way to Jesus through astrology is going to have to unlearn some things, although in a kind of gentle, loving way, rather than kind of beating people over the head with a creed.
I think that's absolutely right, and I think, you know, to double back then to the episode we did about a Christian understanding of evil. Again, I think this is where perhaps there's a vulnerability in our current Christian teaching and understanding framework, particularly amongst Protestant and evangelicals, in that there's this aspect of Christian teaching has been de-emphasized and almost airbrushed out. This understanding of the spiritual battle, this understanding that evil spirits are real, and that spiritual attack is a real phenomenon which you have to recognize and discern. You know, if this is not an element of our teaching, then I fear that these new converts who come out of this enchanted, re-enchanted world may actually still be vulnerable to darker forces.
I think you're right. And I think the other thing that's worth noting in this conversation is how some people draw lines from these re-enchanted people to kind of older, more mystical forms of faith. So things like the resurgence and interest in orthodoxy in Western Europe and North America, which doesn't have a particular tradition of orthodoxy. And yet you're seeing trickles of converts, both from established evangelical mainline churches, but also from kind of functional atheism. And some people say this is because orthodoxy didn't get as disenchanted as Protestant post-Reformation Christianity did. It retained belief in the kind of mystical, spiritual elements of the world, and it's got, you know, you kind of belief in, and true to it, to elements of Catholicism as well, belief in saints and in miracles and in asceticism and monasticism, and it's bodily and very multisensory. In a way that I think a lot of our post-Enlightenment Reformation kind of very cerebral Protestant Christianity just doesn't attract the kind of Gen Zer who is wanting to explore spirituality.
Yes, it's interesting, isn't it? I've heard it described as people want a full-fat spirituality, a full-fat Christianity. They want the whole thing, whereas modern Protestant or evangelical faith is seen as sort of semi-skimmed, you know, that it's taken away a lot of that that really esoteric and emphasis on the pre-modern world, and I can see both ways. I can see how that is very attractive to a Gen Zer who is seeking something, reacting against the atheism and the modernity and so on. I can absolutely see the attraction of that kind of orthodox faith. I suppose what I would want to caution is that where I think orthodoxy has struggled is engagement in the modern world, is what John Stott called double listening, this way of building a bridge into the modern world and the issues facing modern world. And to be honest, what we're trying to do in this podcast, you know, of engaging in the stuff. Historically, orthodoxy has tended to say, you know, if you want to join us, you do it our way. And basically, we're not actively engaging into the modern world.
Yes. And I think in the kind of late 20th century kind of seeker sensitive kind of world, that sense of this is who we are, we do what we've always done, and you either take it or leave it, was very criticized, I think, by a lot of evangelicals who were kind of very taken by this idea that we needed to reinterpret the faith and make it lower bars to entry. And yet, paradoxically, again, you have some people arguing the whole point of the appeal of orthodoxy is that it is profoundly it doesn't make any compromises. It says that we are doing what we've been doing since, you know, the very early days of the church. We'll carry on doing it forever, whether there's one of us or millions, and you can come and join in if you want. And some people, it is said, kind of that is appealing even to young people as a kind of refuge from the chaos and the kind of radical narcissistic subjectivity, moral relativism, as a refuge from the kind of chaos of moral relativism, the kind of narcissism of modern life, which says you are responsible for discerning your own meaning. Maybe the kind of the slightly arrogance of something like orthodoxy, but also potentially Catholicism, which says we're not going to make any compromises to modernity. We are going to carry on doing what we're doing. Maybe that is appealing to some people.
Yes, it's interesting. I'm just thinking about a quite influential author called Paul Kingsnorth, who has written he previously was very much in the kind of ecology and eco-green movement, and a very strong activist, a very influential writer, novelist, and so on, who converted to Christianity and has become an Orthodox Christian. And he's recently written a book called Against the Machine, which he is invades in a very sophisticated way against this whole, the machine of modernity and technology and everything. And his analysis, I think, of modern culture is extremely incisive and very, very well articulated. But when it comes to what his solution is, he basically says, well, either you can have the full experience, which is completely work away, you know, remove yourself from modernity, remove yourself, you know, do not have nothing to do with this, a kind of Amish, even more extreme than the Amish, no technology, nothing at all, you know, or else there's a kind of half-baked version of this where you treat it all with great care and contempt, and but you know you can't avoid going to the supermarket, unfortunately, but nonetheless you minimize it, you keep yourself as much as possible from it. But it lacks that sort of, you know, and people have critiqued the book saying, yes, but where's the positive engagement? This is, you know, how can we redeem this? How can we live redemptively in the modern world? Mm. And I think it just illustrates the fact that this orthodox way of thinking doesn't tend to lead to these positive, redemptive engagement.
And at this, we're coming across kind of cleavages within Christian tradition that go back thousands of years, whereas some parts of the church have a fundamentally kind of positive view of the world and see it as, yes, it's broken and fallen, but there's lots of good stuff going on there, and God wants us to be incarnational and to get out there and to shape culture for the good and to call out, you know, see his common grace, signs of his common grace everywhere. And then there are other streams of Christianity which are more skeptical and negative about the world and see it as corrupting and polluting and you know, ultimately doomed to destruction, and your job as the church is to kind of maintain a faithful remnant. It's interesting to see how you can kind of take the re-enchantment thesis along either streams, because some, you could say charismatic Pentecostal Christianity is also very mystical and full fat and multi-sensory and very much enchanted. It's very anti kind of modern, anti-enlightenment, in the sense of belief in the gifts of the spirit and of miracles, and their worship style is very spontaneous and all that stuff. And yet it doesn't have that kind of skepticism about the world. Christianity wants to, you know, embrace the world with a hug and a smile and love it back to fullness and life. And that can sometimes kind of lead to naivety, but it's a very different posture while also being a kind of re-enchanted version of faith.
Yeah, so maybe just to sort of sum it all up, I think I don't want to end up on a negative perspective. I do feel a great thankfulness to God for the new openness which we're seeing, particularly amongst young people. You know, I'm hearing this repeatedly from my friends working amongst students and young people. We're seeing it in our churches. And I think that, you know, for the old fogies like me, I don't want to be shaking my head and saying, well, it's all very dangerous. You know, I want to be positive about this and say, thank God, you know, the Spirit is at work in new ways. But I do want to emphasize, you know, the renewed importance of spiritual formation. I mean, a lot of people call this discipleship and discipling. I personally feel that, although of course it is a biblical word, it's a word which is wide open to misunderstanding in the modern world. I think the whole thing about discipling is very close to discipline and can very easily lead us on to the abuse scandals and so on. I think the concept of spiritual formation, which again is a very biblical idea, of this process of being transformed ultimately to become more like Jesus every day, and it is really important, and it will be especially important for people coming out of the Gen Z re-enchanted world.
Mm. And there's this very strong theme in the New Testament about the need for Christians to kind of grow into maturity. And maybe one lens to see this is the young people who are dabbling with occultic spirituality and exploring re-enchantment and kind of questioning some of the taken for the assumptions taken for granted by their parents and grandparents about the kind of sterile, secular, atheistic universe that we think we live in. Maybe that's an interesting kind of childish playing around with the idea, and the church's responsibility is to help guide people into a spiritual maturity. So not to say, you know, put aside these silliness and get back to the facts. Say, yes, you're right. There is more to life than atoms and molecules. But actually, some of these things, Reiki, crystals and manifesting, these are dead ends. These are spiritual dead ends. And what we want is to give you some real meat to get your teeth into. A real spirit, the spirit of the living God, who can lead us into all truth.
Yeah, there's a very relevant verse in 1 Corinthians chapter 14, verse 20. Stop thinking like children. In regard to evil, be infants, but in your thinking, be mature. And so Paul saw this in the early church, didn't he? He saw a lot of naivety and spiritual naivety. And his longing was that the people would grow up into Christ, into the full maturity. And discernment is part of that maturity, being able to spot, you know, where something goes wrong, where it something that starts off good and then tracks off into evil, being aware of the possibility of deceptions of evil and so on.
Mm. Okay, well, let's end it there. We'd love to know your thoughts on this kind of re-enchantment thesis, which has been generating a lot of thought beyond this podcast. We've only really touched some of the ideas. Do you think there's truth to it? Is it a boon to the church? Is it something dangerous that we should stand against? Is it somewhere in the middle? How can we as Christians respond to a generation that seems to be dissatisfied with the kind of sterile materialism bequeathed to them by the 20th century? Let us know. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. You can also find lots of interesting resources on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And you can find some of my writing and journalism, which, you know, cover some of these topics around church growth and cultural analysis as well. At my website, tswyatt.com. And in particular, I'd urge you to sign up to my weekly newsletter on church news called The Critical Friend, which you can do for free through that website as well. Thanks for listening, everyone. We'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
If you follow Jesus, you're already doing God's work, not just on Sundays or in church, but in those emails and financial reports, the kitchen tables, or on the school run. I'm pastor and author Tom Nelson, and in my new podcast, God's Work, we're going to completely change how you think about your job. So step into my office for some weekly workplace wisdom. Search God's Work with Tom Nelson on Premiere Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.